Welcome to iHeartRadio Communities, a public affairs special focusing on the biggest issues impacting you this week. Here's Ryan Gorman.
Thanks for joining us here on iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman, and we have some great conversations lined up for you. In a moment, we're going to spend some time discussing freedom of speech, including your right to protest, and how what you say online can impact other areas of your life. Plus, we'll speak with a behavioral scientist about how Americans are dealing with the disruption resulting from the coronavirus pandemic and steps you can take to minimize frustration and anxiety. To get things started, I'm joined now by Ken Paulson, founder of One for All, director of the Free Speech Center at Middle Tennessee State University, and former editor-in-chief of USA Today. Ken, thanks for spending some time with us. And let's start with an overview of the First Amendment. Most people have a general idea of what's included, but there could be some aspects of it they've forgotten or didn't even realize were included in the amendment.
Absolutely. In fact, surveys show that only 2% of Americans can tell you right now, if you call them on the phone and ask them, what does the First Amendment contain? Only 2% actually know. A full third of Americans don't know any of the freedoms, can't name a single freedom. And we live in a nation in which, oddly enough, almost every American can recite the Pledge of Allegiance, and for that matter, the lead characters on Game of Thrones, but we don't know the five freedoms of the First Amendment. We have to remember that way back in 1791, Americans were inventing their own government essentially on the run. It was 1789 when we had our Constitution. But the first generation of Americans said, hey, we're not going to give the government all this power, a presidency, a judiciary, a legislative branch called Congress, unless you give us some guarantees. So if you promise these promises, if you won't search our property, if you won't put soldiers in our home during peacetime, if you allow us to bear arms, and above all else, these are most important. We want to worship the God of our choice, say whatever we want, write whatever we want, petition the government for change, and assemble together in the town square without being shot. No more Boston massacres. That combination, the five freedoms of the First Amendment, freedom of speech, press, religion, petition, and assembly, together give us free expression in this country. And actually, those are the most potent guarantees of freedom of expression anywhere in the history of the world, even today.
And that leads right into my next question about why this amendment was so revolutionary, such a game changer. The world had never seen something like this before, correct?
Absolutely. We have to remember that most of our country's roots come from countries in which there was either royalty or some other restrictive form of government. And the notion that people are born free was actually something that didn't really emerge until several centuries ago. And so the notion that a government would say, you know what, we have the power, and we're going to share it. In fact, you are the power. The power of the people would drive the future of America. And then they built in this fascinating commitment, which was going to make this a more perfect union. We're going to get better. We're going to evolve. And that's been the secret of America, because even though our first generation of leaders did not free the slaves, we used the power of those five freedoms, protesting, to eventually abolish slavery. Even though they didn't have the wisdom to give women a full participation in society, the suffrage movement used the First Amendment to ensure that women had a vote and a voice. That's been the miracle of America. Those five freedoms allow us to fix things, make things better, take a stand for change, and make a positive difference.
So what are some of the most common misconceptions about freedom of speech?
I would think the single most misunderstood thing about freedom of speech is that the First Amendment only protects us against our government. So the government can't limit what you say, but your employer can. The people you associate with can criticize you. There's nothing about the First Amendment that allows you to say things without any social consequence. And people, you know, sort of will say outrageous things or say hateful things or racially insensitive things and say, hey, it's free speech. Sure, you have the right. The government can't stop you from saying something that's troubling the people around you. But that doesn't mean those folks can't take action, can't ostracize you, can't turn their backs on you. Free speech is just a license, but just because you say it doesn't mean it's a good thing to say.
I'm joined by Ken Paulson, founder of One for All, director of the Free Speech Center at Middle Tennessee State University, and former editor-in-chief of USA Today. Just following up on that point, talk a little bit about the power that businesses have to take action against an employee based on something they say. We've certainly seen that recently, people speaking out and offering up their opinion, but then losing their job because of it.
Absolutely. We don't have First Amendment rights in our workplace. And if you don't believe that, I suggest you try to march on your boss tomorrow morning and see what happens. The truth is that the only things that protect us from getting fired any day for any reason are protected categories. So if they fire you because of your age or your disability or because you're a woman or because you're a member of a minority, all of those things, if that's the reason they fired you, you can appeal and file suit in court. But otherwise, most Americans, if you're a 30-year-old non-minority male and they don't like the look of your tie, they can fire you. There's no protection for that. Of course, there are union rules. Some people have contracts. But most Americans are vulnerable to being fired any day just because. That's it. And so when somebody posts something online that is highly embarrassing, and the news stories all say that so-and-so works at Allstate Insurance, Allstate can fire him because he's caused, period. They just can fire him. They don't have to have a reason. But they would want to fire this person because they embarrassed the company, associated a respected company with racism or sexism. You can go overnight. That's the way it works. And the First Amendment is not going to help you in any way.
What would be an example of the government going too far and crossing a line that potentially puts some form of freedom of speech at risk?
Well, in terms of freedom of speech, I think the area that has where most of the litigation occurs right now is actually in public schools. If a student wants to wear a T-shirt with a political message, or wants to have a car parked in the parking lot that has like a rebel flag on the back of it, can a school limit that behavior? Similarly, we see college campuses, and the good news is fewer of these all the time, but they will create what they call a free speech zone, a specific place where if students want to express their opinion, they have to go. These are areas that are more likely to be problematic, the government limits speech. By and large, so much of this has been litigated, you know, government knows better than to go in and try to muzzle someone standing on a street corner expressing their opinion. We don't see blatant infringements on freedom of speech. Now, what we do see increasingly are limits on, particularly on assembly, and we've seen that around the country for a couple of months now. There are times when the government intrudes on freedom of speech, press, religion in particular, but lately it's been assembly.
I'm joined by Ken Paulson, founder of One for All, director of the Free Speech Center at Middle Tennessee State University, and former editor-in-chief of USA Today. Let's talk about protesting. What are the rights of protesters in this country?
Well, we have the right to speak out against our government. And as individuals, we can do that almost anywhere we wish on public property. But there is something called time, place, and manner in terms of law of assembly. So what that means is, I know you want to protest. Yeah, I know you want to march. Wonderful. Exercise your First Amendment rights. But you may not exercise those at 5 p.m. marching down Broadway just as commuters are getting into their cars. That would clog the streets. We can arrange to have you do that at 3 p.m. or we can arrange to have you do that somewhere else in the city. But a government has a right not to deny a protest, but to set limits on when, where, and how. Same thing would be, you have the right to be on the street corner, and you can shout to everybody what you think about the president or whatever you care to, but you can't necessarily use a megaphone because that loud noise will affect businesses in the area. So basically, they can't deny you the right to protest, but the government has a lot of control over where and how you do it, including asking you to get a license, a permit to do that. Now, here's what's fascinating you know, we watch a lot of television now in which we see a lot of stress and strife on the streets because law enforcement's coming face to face with protesters. But this is a little surprising. Across this country, cities, towns, municipalities have been very cool about this. They could demand a license, a permit for people to gather, 25 people to gather when they gather like suddenly and they don't expect it. But throughout this, they have not been insisting on that because they recognize how powerful this movement is. They understand that if they start denying permits, they will exacerbate an already bad situation. It's something that hasn't been recognized, but there's been really admirable restraint by cities just letting the people protest. And yes, there's some limits, and they push them back, and they say, you can't go here. But by and large, the right to protest in America has been really protected, and as a result, has been very robust.
One term that people often hear is hate speech, and there are some who want to limit it. What is hate speech, and can it cross a line that would make it unconstitutional?
Well, this may be a surprising answer, but hate speech is always protected. There is no line. And in saying that, hate speech to me would be to say things that deeply offend someone of another race or faith, that denigrate them, that make them uncomfortable. None of those are good things, but they're all protected by the First Amendment. And here's why. Back in 1791, as I said, we ratified the Bill of Rights to the Constitution. We had to decide what kind of nation we were going to be. And we were, you know, surprisingly, even though we're very polarized today, we were extremely polarized in many ways at the very birth of this country. You know, they started newspapers not because of advertising revenue. There were no malls in colonial Maryland or first generation Maryland. Anyway, so what you did was start a newspaper to attack political rivals, to say hateful things about George Washington. In fact, that's one of the reasons George Washington didn't pursue a third term. He just had had it with the criticism and the anger and the conflict. And so so basically, we created a system where you could say anything to anybody at all, and your right would be protected. Because it's common sense. Think about it. You never have to protect popular speech against government incursion. You have to protect unpopular speech. So we had a test of that in the beginning of the country. John Adams, second president, supports the Alien and Sedition Act, and people are jailed because of hateful things they said about John Adams. By the turn of the century, and that would be 1800, we regained our balance, and we said, no, that's not what this country is about. So the bottom line is the First Amendment was created. The right to speak freely was created because we wanted to protect hateful, angry, protesting speech. And that's where we are today. No one says hate speech is a good thing, but having the ability to express your view, no matter how controversial, that is a very good thing.
Now, when it comes to speech that threatens a person or a group of people or tries to incite violence, that's a different story, and action can be taken against someone who does that, right?
Excellent point, yes. And when you think about it, no one's speech is being limited because what is being punished is the action. So, for example, people always say you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Well, you can't yell anything in a crowded theater. If I get up in the middle, we all hope we have theaters again, and people will be crowded into these theaters and healthy. But if I get up in the middle of that and yell, God bless George Washington and the First Amendment over and over again, they're taking me out. Is it because they don't like George Washington or the First Amendment? No, because my action is disrupting the film. If I yell fire in a crowded theater, it's not because they object to the word fire. It's because I am creating a panic, a dangerous public situation. If someone, a criminal, tries to hire someone to commit murder, well, that speech is not protected because it's not technically speech. It's inviting someone else to create a crime, have a crime occur. So the bottom line is those limits are really on conduct, and they're not on the words themselves.
I'm joined by Ken Paulson, founder of One for All, director of the Free Speech Center at Middle Tennessee State University, and former editor-in-chief of USA Today. Final question for you. Social media's role in all of this. We hear lots of debate about censorship, what social media companies can and should prohibit, what they should allow. What powers do these companies have over the content on their sites, and how does that fit in with the First Amendment?
Well, if we go back and analyze the First Amendment, we say a government shall make no law, but it doesn't say Twitter shall make no law. And so private companies can decide what rules they want to operate by. They tell the public, this is who we are, this is what we do, and here's the appropriate conduct, and here's the inappropriate conduct. And they have a choice. They can say, it's the Wild West. Just go for it. We're not going to interfere at all. Or they're going to say, you know what, we're going to moderate this. We're going to make sure that nothing creates harm to society in terms of bad information about the coronavirus and all of that. So actually, Twitter and Facebook and all these businesses have their own First Amendment rights to decide how they're going to operate. And the challenge for them is to be consistent. And it's a shame that we don't actually have a few more social media companies with comparable clout, because then everyone, can make a choice about what environment they want to express their views. I think a lot of Americans would welcome a Facebook that actually doesn't have as much outrage and hate as it does. But others would welcome probably, a free-flowing conversation. I will say this, that if Jefferson and Madison and the boys were still around, they would all be very active on social media. What we are seeing now is the ultimate fruition of their dream, creating a nation in which everyone has a voice. It's incredible. Someone sitting in their bedroom in the middle of Ohio can tweet something that changes the path of American history. What power, what impact, and that's the America that first generation had in mind.
Ken Paulson, founder of One for All, director of the Free Speech Center at Middle Tennessee State University, and former editor-in-chief of USA Today. Ken, thank you for taking the time to have this discussion with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And finally, for some insight into how people are dealing with these unprecedented times, including this current pandemic and all the disruption it's caused, I'm joined by Dr. Leslie Beisch, chair of the Department of Behavioral Sciences and Social Medicine at the Center for Medicine and Public Health at Florida State University. Dr. Beisch, thank you for your time. And let me start here. Is there any comparable situation in modern history when it comes to the disruption we're seeing throughout society and potential changes in people's behavior?
I actually think we've had quite a few, just not in recent times. I think our parents would remember how they adjusted to fears of polio. That was more of a summer concern that they would have had. And if you go back to maybe your grandparents and great-grandparents during the great influenza era of World War I, the situation was really quite similar about avoiding crowds, less about wearing masks, of course, but also fear of the unknown.
When society is going through an event that causes this kind of disruption, what are some shifts in behavior that behavioral scientists keep a close eye on?
Well, I think, people in different circumstances behave somewhat differently. Many people are, in fact, anxious. And that anxiety can lead some people to respond aggressively. And I think we see news media reports of that. People ask to wear masks, respond, sometimes in very unfortunate situations with violence. We have people who isolate themselves even more and have no support systems. And, of course, we want them to be relatively isolated, but it leads to loneliness and despair and potentially depression and, and suicidal thoughts, those kinds of things. So you have some really remarkable, kinds of extremes that people have. And then we have a lot of other folks who, take that adjustment in stride and recognize that, they can wear a mask, they can socially distance, they think about different ways to maintain their relationships by using technology. So people cope in very different ways.
You mentioned something there that I want to follow up on. One of the major differences between what we're facing now and what the country dealt with before a polio vaccine was invented or back a century ago during the influenza pandemic, technology. How does technology play into people's behavior and their ability to deal with the disruption, or does it in some cases have an adverse effect?
Yeah, great question. I think like so many other things in our society, it's a double-edged sword. I think the ability to connect with loved ones and support systems through, you know, whether it's a telephone or email or the equivalent of Zoom or FaceTime, all of those things, it's just so tremendous. If you're trying to get hold of parents and loved ones who are in assisted living facilities or nursing homes, and they're not allowing people to enter, and you want to be safe, that's a great form of connection. On the flip side of that, when we're looking at social media and you find so much misinformation and so much distortion of factual information, whether we're talking about the incorrect kinds of behaviors that we want people to otherwise do. So, you know, we live in that. That's the most unusual part of our time. You know, you asked me that question earlier, Ryan. Have we lived in times like this? We have. But I think the technology and the 24/7 media change how we may grapple with the circumstances we face.
I'm joined by Dr. Leslie Beisch, chair of the Department of Behavioral Sciences and Social Medicine at the Center for Medicine and Public Health at Florida State University. Taking a step away from the pandemic for a moment, how has social media and recent technological advances changed human behavior?
You know, I people write their PhD dissertations on that subject. There's just so many aspects that are so broad to that, and just as many that are so nuanced. We expect immediate gratification of so many things in our society, and social media fulfills that. Think about the times you've been with, if you have adolescent children or you're an adolescent at any age, how often people can go for 5 minutes without looking at the text they're getting or checking an email or, you know, otherwise being distracted. Even when they're sitting next to someone and potentially engaging in a conversation, hopefully socially distanced and masked. So we have to be in contact 24/7. And again, if we think about our grandparents and great-grandparents, they went to bed when it got dark outside. So, you know, it's really, they read about things in the newspaper, and often those things were days out of the way. And before that, people getting information when the mail was delivered by the Pony Express. So, you know, our thirst for information is now no longer measured in days and weeks, but it's measured in nanoseconds. And that becomes the expectation. And we expect our wants and needs to be met immediately. And, you know, there's some good things to that end, and some things that are, again, create stress and uncertainty.
What are the differences between behavioral changes in children and adults during something like this? Adults obviously have a lot on their plate, protecting the family, financial concerns, but kids, they've got their own thing going on, and this experience has certainly upended their lives too.
Sure. Well, first of all, children, you know, of all ages, you know, take cues from what their parents are doing and how their parents are responding. So parents who are, again, taking things in stride are modeling that behavior for their children. And, of course, parents who are wearing masks, or social distancing, and all of those things, they're normalizing that behavior for their kids. You know, younger children, you know, may not actually notice much disruption. They aren't going to daycare, but they're still able to play. Children who would be in school, you know, are trying to figure out that balance between, you know, academics that they're supposed to be having. It's been summer, so that there's been a little break from that, and they're kind of play, and they're not sure why they're not able to see all their friends. And depending how parents capably explain that, you know, is an interesting kind of dimension to it. You know, adolescents, you know, are very social, but again, they're using a lot of social media. So for it can be really interesting. I'm thinking about adolescents in my own home who can be right next to one another and still be communicating via text or via Instagram or what have you. And I find that interesting. So, you know, in many respects, they can have their same lifestyle now, and even though they're socially, should be socially distanced. But I think one of the biggest threats as a public health person to responding to this pandemic is continuing to keep people from gathering in large groups who have been closeted away for months, and they are really getting COVID phobia at this point. They need to. They don't fully grasp that they're bringing disease home to their family members potentially, and you know, any age above 10, there's pretty significant data out there emerging that they're able to share whatever disease they pick up and bring it home, and so that poses a number of questions or concerns that we should also be having. So, you know, that social behavior that is so important for adolescents and young adults, and they're trying to, again, normalize their behavior right now, get back to normal. We're not going to get back to normal right away.
Does geography also play into behavioral changes, an urban-rural divide?
I do think that, you know, the sort of pace of life, you know, is very different in those years, and it's probably a lot harder to maintain distance. And I'm thinking New York City, when you can hear your neighbors behind the next wall, versus you're living in a farm that might be a little bit more isolated from others, and your normal lifestyle maybe have limited interpersonal relationships with it, someone. So I can imagine that would be the case. And you often have to travel long distances in rural areas to interact with other people, to receive services and other things. So they're more likely to be cut off. And, you know, that can have some positive aspects, again, like some of the things we've discussed, but also some negative ones, like accessing needed services and so on, particularly if they don't have access to food and, you know, and that kind of thing, medicine.
I'm joined by Dr. Leslie Beisch, chair of the Department of Behavioral Sciences and Social Medicine at the Center for Medicine and Public Health at Florida State University. Finally, in your experience and based on all the research you've looked at and studied, are there steps people can take to limit the frustration and anxiety they're feeling during these chaotic times, or at least measures that can help them deal with those moments when they hit?
It really can be a difficult set of circumstances, and you're right to focus on that. And you know, one of the tips that I like to use is trying to deal with one thing at a time. You know, the whole overwhelming process could be, you know, just incredibly frightening. You're laid off from work. You can't pay your mortgage or your rent. You don't know how you're going to buy groceries. And trying to break that up into much smaller bites. And again, you know, how you present your disposition and your coping skills and how that's presented to others in your family is modeling certain behavioral norms. And so if parents are, you know, from stress and anxiety from the things I just mentioned, if they're taking it more in stride, then other members of the family will as well. And so that de-escalates some of those things. But there's just no question, these are very difficult times, and we're relying on political leaders and family and friends to a much greater extent than our normal life, we would have to do that. So it is a unique period in our history.
Dr. Leslie Beisch, chair of the Department of Behavioral Sciences and Social Medicine at the Center for Medicine and Public Health at Florida State University, thank you for joining us and sharing your expertise. We appreciate it.
And thank you for having me, Ryan. Appreciate that.
And a big thanks to all of the guests that come on this show, and of course to all of you for listening. You can find previous episodes on your iHeartRadio app. Just search for iHeartRadio Communities, and you can find me on social media at Ryan E. Gorman. We'll be back here same time, same place next weekend. Stay safe.